Chapter 7. On an oppressive day, and under a low and troubled sky, the Surprise made her way along the channel between Albemarle and Narborough, the westernmost islands of the Galapagos. She was finding it uncommonly difficult. For although at present the capricious breeze was favourable, she had to stem a powerful tide setting against all reason from the north. Against all reason, for, as Mr. Allen observed, an even stronger current beyond the Redondo Rock at the far end of the strait ran in the opposite direction at 4 and even 5 miles an hour, while the tide between Albemarle and James Island, only a little way to the east, was in full agreement with it. In her rapid, hound-like casting to and fro among the Galapagos, the Surprise had grown used to very strong, unreasonable currents and unreasonable weather. Fog under the equator, for all love. But this particular current showed every inclination to turn into an extremely dangerous tide rip. And as the rock-strewn channel was one of those the master didn't know, Jack had taken over the deck himself. It was the kind of navigation that he didn't like at all. But this was his last chance of finding the Norfolk in the archipelago. She might be lying in any of the 3 or 4 sheltered bays ahead, filling up with tortoises. Those from Narborough, weighing between 200 and 300 pounds, were particularly good eating. And with what water and firewood the place could afford. And the Surprise might come upon her unawares. The channel, therefore, had to be threaded. Though it was a tricky passage indeed, with a weakening, uncertain wind, a strengthening current, little room to work the ship, an iron-bound coast on either side, and, height of injustice, something very like 2 lee shores, since the wind on the frigate's side urged her towards the rocks of Narborough, while the cross-grained tide and current tended to fling her upon those of Albemarle, and certainly would do so were the wind to carry out its threat of veering. The atmosphere on deck was tense, with all hands at their stations, a boat carrying a kedge and hawser out on either side, and a man in the chains continually heaving the lead and continually chanting, "No bottom with this line! No bottom, nay, nay!" The strait narrowed steadily, and it seemed to Jack that he would almost certainly have to anchor until the height of flood, even if it meant letting the best bower go in 100 fathoms. "Light along the deep sea line," he said. For some time the shores had been less than a musket shot apart, and now they were much nearer, increasing the force of the current. All hands looked at them gravely. A wicked surf beating upon black rock on either side, and on either side a vast, fissured expanse of dull black naked lava sloping up to vague, mist-covered heights, the lava scattered with great heaps of volcanic clinkers, mostly black but sometimes an unhealthy red, like the waste of an enormous ironworks. Here and there a crater, an inhuman landscape. Or almost all hands. The surgeon and the chaplain, either ignorant of the implications of tide rip, unplumbed depth, uncertain breeze and want of sea room, or soaring above these things, were settled at the leeward rail, focusing their telescopes with eager, even trembling hands. They'd earlier made an attempt at covering either shore so as to miss nothing, calling their discoveries out to one another across the deck. But the officer of the watch had put a stop to this wild irregularity the moment Jack appeared, the windward side being sacred to the captain. And now they were obliged to be content with Narborough alone. Yet even so, as they confessed, there was enough to occupy a score of naturalists. They had soon discovered that the miserable sterility of the lower slopes was more apparent than real. Several stunted leafless shrubs, almost certainly related to the euphorbias, could be made out standing among the natural slag heaps, and prickly pears of an uncommon height, together with tall columnar cacti, were almost common on the upper slopes. But interesting though the land was, without a doubt, the sea was even more so. As the strait grew narrower, so the life in it seemed to become more concentrated. The shores on either hand, and not only the little beaches of black sand and pebbles, but even the seemingly inaccessible ledges, were crowded with seals. Eared seals, sea lions and sea bears, lying on their stomachs, on their backs, on their sides, sleeping or making love or merely barking, while others played in the crashing surf or swam by the ship, stretching their necks up and staring with intense curiosity. And where the seals left any room, the higher rocks were covered with marine iguanas, black, crested, and a good yard long. Penguins and flightless cormorants shared the water, swimming with great speed just under the surface, weaving among the shoals of silvery, pilchard-like fish. And in the surprise's wake, a band of female sperm whales with their calves lay blowing on the surface. Over her deck flew quantities of seabirds, which was natural enough. But what was less so was the number that assembled in the rigging, on the hammocks in their netting, and on the belfry, maddening the hands who had to clean up their copious messes, messes that quickly ate into the metal of the guns. Many a privy blow with a swab did the larger birds receive when the doctor wasn't looking, but it was no use. They remained obstinately tame, settling on the gunwales of the boats alongside and even on their very oars. Most of these birds were boobies, masked boobies, brown boobies, spotted boobies, but above all, blue-faced boobies, heavy-witted birds with a slow, expressionless stare. Once, in the far Atlantic, they'd been the rarities of the world, but now, although the approach of their breeding season had quickened their minds and turned the webs of their feet an even lovelier turquoise, they were nothing in comparison with the land birds, little sooty finches or rails that passed by, the land birds being, as far as they could tell, of kinds unknown to the learned world. Yet, in spite of the boobies being so common, one couple did fix Stephen's eye. They were perched on the back of a sleeping turtle, an amorous pair with glowing feet, and so great was their need and urgency, the day being unusually warm and propitious for boobies, that they were going through their ritual of courtship with extraordinary speed. And there was no doubt that the cock booby would have attained his end if the turtle hadn't submerged a moment too soon, leaving him strangely out of countenance. The master paused behind them, and pointing to Narborough Island, said, "There's Sodom and Gomorrah, gentlemen, I believe. But it's not so bad higher up the slope. Was the cloud to lift, you could see some green up there. Bushes and trees all covered with a kind of Spanish moss." "Oh, we're quite confident," said Martin, turning a happy face to him. "This is the first time we've been near enough to see the land at all clearly, to see the iguanas plain. I particularly admire the tall, straight cactus," said Stephen. "We call them torch thistles," said the master, "and they have a kind of juice, if you cut them down, that can be drunk. But it gives you the wet gripes." The ship sailed on. The black, scaly shore moved slowly past, and amidst the cry of nautical orders, the patter of bare feet, the creak of yards, and the general song of the wind in the rigging, part of Stephen's mind wandered away. A small bird perched on his telescope, cocked its head, looked inquisitively at him, and then preened its black feathers for a while before flying off to the island, where it vanished against the lava. "That was quite certainly a nondescript," he said, and went on, "I have been contemplating on the mating ceremonies of our own kind. Sometimes they are almost as brief as the boobies. That's when two of a like inclination exchange kind looks and after a short parley retire from view. I'm thinking of Herodotus' account of the Greek and Amazon warriors in the pause after their truce for dinner, when individuals from either army would wander among the bushes, and of some more recent examples that have fallen under my own observation. At other times, however, the evolutions of the ceremonial dance, with its feigned advances and feigned withdrawals, its ritual offerings and symbolic motions, are protracted beyond measure, lasting perhaps for years before the right true end is reached, if indeed it's reached at all, and not spoilt entirely by the long delay. There are endless variations according to time and country and class, and the finding out of common factors running through them all is a fascinating pursuit." "Yes, indeed," said Martin, "and it's clearly of the first importance to the race. I wonder some writer hasn't made it his particular study. The ceremony, I mean, not the act itself, which is nasty, brutish, and short." He reflected for a moment, and then, smiling, he went on, "Yet a man of war is scarcely the place for your inquiries. That's to say..." His smile faded and his voice died away, as he remembered Friday past, when, according to the custom of the sea, Horner's effects were put up for auction at the mast, and where some pitiful shawls and petticoats were seen, an auction at which no man thought it right to bid, not even Wilkins, now the frigate's acting gunner. "Now, Doctor," said Howard, passing him a hat with several small dead birds in it, "ain't I a good boy? Not one's the same." Under the weight of public opinion, Howard had given up shooting, and apart from catching fish and harpooning turtles and dolphins, which made capital sausages when mixed with the ship's salt pork, his sport now consisted of killing the birds that settled about the rigging. The boobies, owls, frigate birds, brown pelicans and hawks he strangled. The smaller ones he struck down with a switch. Stephen accepted them because he disliked killing specimens himself, but with all the force at his command, he had urged the marine to be moderate, not to take more than a few of the same kind, and prevent his men from doing them any harm. "You're most attentive, Mr. Howard," said Stephen, "and I am particularly obliged to you for this yellow-breasted wren, a bird I've not..." "Oh! Oh!" cried Martin. "I see a giant tortoise! I see two giant tortoises! Heavens, such tortoises! Where? Where?" "By the prickly pear." The tall prickly pear had an almost tree-like trunk. One tortoise, craning a tiptoe, had seized a branch and was pulling with all the force of his retractile neck and huge domed body. The other had also seized it and was pulling too, though in a different direction. Martin interpreted this as an example of slightly mistaken mutual aid, Stephen as one of self-interest. But before the point could be settled, the branch, or rather the series of palms, broke in two, and each reptile walked off with his own. "How I yearn to set foot on at least one of these islands," said Martin. "Such discoveries to be made in every realm. If the reptilian order can run to such extreme magnificence, what may we not expect from the coleoptera, from the butterflies, But I'm tormented by the thought that a ship may sail on and on, perpetually on and on. Here the goat Aspasia came running to Stephen for protection. Ever since the ship had reached the coast of Albemarle, small, dark grey finches with stout beaks had been persecuting her, landing on her back and plucking out hair to line their nests. She'd faced the elements, thunder, lightning, two fleet actions, four between single ships. She'd faced midshipmen, ship's boys, and a large variety of dogs, but this she could not bear. And every time she heard their faint twitter come aboard, she hurried to Stephen. "Come, come," he said, "a great goat like you, for shame." But he flapped at the finches and went on speaking to Martin. "Set your heart at rest. Captain Aubrey has promised that once his search for the Norfolk is over, the ship shall lie up, or to, or in, and that we shall have leave to go ashore." How you relieve my mind. I really couldn't have borne... See, see, another tortoise, a Goliath, and nearer still he walks down the slope. A ponderous tread. They focused their telescopes on Goliath, who paused in perfect view, so well turned to the light that they could even count his plates, comparing them with those of Testudo Aubrey on the Indian Ocean, which Maturin had discovered, described and named, giving Jack his only likelihood of earthly immortality, and with the thin-shelled and lighter, though still respectable, tortoise of Rodriguez. Reflections upon insular tortoises, their origin, tortoises in general, whether deaf, their voices rarely heard, capable of a harsh cry, however, as well as the more usual hiss, careless of their young, crocodiles more diligent as parents, but tortoises more generally sympathetic, perfectly capable of attachment, instances of affection in tortoises. "What is all this intemperate calling out?" asked Stephen without taking his eye from the telescope. A whole troop of tortoises had come into his field of vision, all walking steadily uphill on a distinctly beaten track. "I believe they've seen a boat of some kind. There was some mention of a boat," said Martin. "Would this island yield a toad, do you suppose? There are few reptiles I prefer to toads. And a toad of such heroic dimensions... If a tortoise, why not a toad? But now that I come to recollect, I found no batrachians of any kind on Rodriguez, and I could scarcely make an intelligent native understand what I meant by a frog, though I imitated his motions in a very lively manner and his cry. By your leisure, by your leave!" roared the captain of the afterguard, shouldering his way between them without the least ceremony, as the pipes wailed for all hands about ship, and the seamen ran to their places. "Why, Beckett, what's afoot?" asked Stephen. But before Beckett could reply, the surprise began her smooth turn. The familiar cry of "Helms a-lee!" was followed by "Off tacks and sheets!" and then by "Mainsail haul!" She passed sweetly through stays in spite of the encumbrance of the cutters, and at this point Stephen, looking ahead, saw a distant boat, a whaleboat, pulling towards them as fast as ever it could against the current. The surprise filled on the larboard tack, and although the tide was slackening near its height, in a quarter of an hour she'd lost the distance she'd taken three to gain. The boat came visibly nearer every minute. A whaleboat with six men aboard. But so great was their anxiety that even when they were within 100 yards and the distance dwindling with each breath, they still pulled furiously hard. They still hailed the ship, ahoy, as loud as ever they could roar. Their voices had almost entirely gone by the time they came grinning up the side, overflowing with happiness. But in a hoarse whisper, interspersed with throaty laughter, and wetted by the two buckets of fresh water they drank, standing there on the deck, their spokesman, the spectioneer, soon made their story plain. They belonged to the Intrepid Fox of London, James Holland, master. She'd been out just over 2 years. And although she'd not been successful up until the time they came to the Galapagos, it had then seemed that they might go home with a full hold, for there they found whales in plenty. They'd killed three the first day, and the boats were out after three more when the fog came down. They themselves were fast to a lively young 40-barrel bull that led them a great dance far to the north of the Redondo Rock, far from their mates, who couldn't see them nor yet bring fresh whale lines. In the end, he carried away lines and harpoon and all, and left them a cruel night and day to pull against wind and current, without a drop to drink, no, nor a morsel to bite. And when they got back, what did they see? Why, they saw the poor old fox being fair pulled to pieces by an American frigate that was not only taking a new foretop mast out of her, but also transferring what oil and spermaceti she'd won, the forehold and perhaps half the main, no more, into another whaler, the Amelia, also from London River. Fortunately, it was the evening, and they were under land, coming down the coast, so they were not seen. The spectioneer had been in these waters before. He knew the island, and they were able to pull into a narrow inlet, hide the boat under driftwood, and climb up to the old buccaneer's shelter. There was a little water up there, though it was briny and evaporating fast. There were tortoises and land iguanas, and the boobies had started to lay, so they managed pretty well upon the whole, though parched. Presently, they saw the Amelia set out, cheered by the American frigate. She was wearing American colours, and she steered a little east of south. Then, the next day, the Americans brought a couple of hundred tortoises down to the beach, ferried them out to the ship, set fire to the Fox, won their anchor, cleared the channel, and stood away to the west. They hurried down to try to put the fire out, but it was no good. Half a dozen barrels of whale oil had been stove, with the oil running all over the deck, and the fire had such a hold there was no getting anywhere near. The captain would see part of a blackened hull if he carried on up the strait. The Fox lay bilged on a reef to the north of Banks Bay, just after the anchorage. "When the American cleared the channel, did she stand due west?" asked Jack.
"Well, sir," said the spectioneer, "maybe a point south of west. Moses Thomas and me, we went up to the shelter again, and we watched her to the horizon, straight as a die, just a trifle south of west, to gallantsails on the fore and main."
"For the Marquesa, spectioneer?"
"That's right, mate. There are half a dozen of us out there, and some Yankees too, now that the sandwiches are not what they was, and New Zealand a disappointment, with the people eating you up if you so much as set foot on shore."
"Good. Very good. Mr. Merritt, these men will be entered on the ship's books. Capital hands, I'm sure, to be rated able. Mr. Adams will issue hammocks, beds, slops, and they'll be excused duty for a couple of days to recover. Mr. Allen, we'll clear the strait with the changing tide and lay a course for the Marquesas."
"No tortoises, sir?" asked Mowat.
"No tortoises. We've been very economical with the ship's provisions, and we can do without tortoises as a relish. No, no, she's 18 days before us, and there's not a moment to lose, either tortoises or caviar or cream in our tea." With this, he went below, looking thoroughly pleased. A few minutes later, Stephen hurried into the cabin.
"When are we to stop?" he cried. "You promised we should stop."
"The promise was subject to the requirements of the service. Listen, Stephen. Here I have my tide, my current, and my wind all combined. My enemy, with a fine head start, so that there's not a moment to be lost. Could I conscientiously delay for the sake of an iguano or a beetle? Interesting, no doubt, but of no immediate application in warfare, candidly, now. Banks was taken to Otto Heite to observe the transit of Venus, which had no immediate practical application. You forget that Banks paid for the endeavour, and that we didn't happen to be engaged in a war at the time. The endeavour was not in pursuit of anything but knowledge. Stephen had not known this. It made him, if anything, angrier still, but he governed himself and said, "As I understand it, you mean to go round the end of this long island on the left and start your voyage, take your departure from the other side." Jack gave a noncommittal nod. "Well, no. Were Martin and I to walk across it, we should be on the other side long before the ship. The proportions are as 1 to 10, so they are. And that small little boat could land us without any trouble at all and take us off. We should walk briskly, pausing only for a few important measurements, and almost certainly making valuable discoveries about springs of fresh water, mineral ores, antiscorbutic vegetables and the like." "Stephen," said Jack, "if the wind and the tide had been against us, I should have said yes. They are not. I am obliged to say no." Landing them through the surf would be difficult. Getting them off again on the west side might be quite impossible. And then the brisk walking of two besotted natural philosophers across a remote oceanic island filled with plants and creatures unknown to science might last until the frigate sank at her moorings or grounded on her beef bones. He'd seen Matcherin on shore before this, with nothing more than a Madeiran woodlouse to make him lose all sense of time. But he was sorry for his friend's disappointment, so much keener than he'd expected from the desperately sterile look of the islands. He was even sorrier to see a tide of anger rise in Stephen's usually impassive face, and to hear the harsh tone in which he said, "Very well, sir. I must submit to superior force, I find. I must be content to form part of a merely belligerent expedition, hurrying past inestimable perils bent solely on destruction, neglecting all discovery, incapable of spending 5 minutes on discovery. I shall say nothing about the corruption of power or its abuse. I shall only observe that, for my part, I look upon a promise as binding, and that until the present I must confess it had never occurred to me that you might not be of the same opinion, that you might have 2 words. "My promise was necessarily conditional," said Jack. "I command a king's ship, not a private yacht. You're forgetting yourself." Then, much more kindly and with a smile, "But I tell you what it is, Stephen. I shall keep in as close with the shore as can be, and you shall look at the creatures with my best achromatic glass," reaching for a splendid 5-lens Dolland, an instrument that Stephen was never allowed to use because of his tendency to drop telescopes into the sea. "You may take your achromatic glass and..." began Stephen. But he checked himself, and after the slightest pause went on, "You are very good, but I have one of my own. I shall trouble you no longer." He was exceedingly angry. His solution, one short side of a triangle as opposed to 2 of immense length, seemed to him unanswerably sound, and it made him angrier still when practically everybody aboard, and not only old friends like Bondon and Killick and the privileged Joe Place, who practically owned the man who had opened his skull and who lived in a state of permanent hostility with Rogers, who had only had an arm off, but Padine, Recent defenders and the mere children of the midshipman's berth surrounded him with exceptional kindness and particular attention. He had always prided himself on maintaining the volto sciolto, pensieri stretti rather better than most men, and here were illiterate tarpaulins comforting him for a distress that he could have sworn was perfectly undetectable. With a surly satisfaction, he observed that in spite of the changing tide, the Surprise did in fact make but a slow passage of her two legs, for the breeze came foul upon her twice. They slowly passed two excellent strands where a boat could have landed them and taken them off. The first, in a cove beyond the reef where the blackened carcass of the whaler lay. And it was clear to him that he and Martin might have crept across the island on all fours and still have been in time. "At half the time," he muttered, beating the rail in an extremity of frustration. He watched the dim, cloud-covered Galapagos vanish astern, and turned in early, ending his usual prayers with one for a less rancorous mind, and lying there in his cot with Boethius de Consolatione Philosophiae and 2 measured ounces of laudanum. Yet in spite of these, he was still unusually ill-tempered at 2 o'clock in the morning, when Padine roused him and very slowly and with great difficulty told him in Irish and English that Mr. Blakeney had swallowed a 4-pound grape shot. "The thing is materially impossible," said Stephen. "The wicked little brute beast is lying, showing away, topping at the Phoenix, making himself interesting. Such a dose I shall give him. The sorrows of Munster will be nothing to his." But when he found the poor brute beast, pale, frightened, apologetic, and put to sit by a lantern on the half-deck, and when he learnt that the grape in question was only one of the 9 that made up the charge of the launch's 4-pounder, he at once had him seized up by the heels, ran for the stomach pump and forced a large quantity of tepid salt water tinged with rum into his body, reflecting with pleasure as, among the agonised retching, he heard the clang of the ball and the basin, that he had cured his patient not only of probably mortal occlusion, but of any taste for spirituous liquors for some time to come. Even so, even with this physical and moral triumph, the next day found him still thoroughly out of humour. And when Adams observed that the captain was to be the gunroom's guest at dinner, that the dinner was to be an uncommon fine one, too, quite a Lord Mayor's feast, he said, "Oh, indeed," in a tone that showed no kind of pleasure. "I have known that fellow hang about in port," he said to himself, glancing at Jack from the lee gangway as the Surprise ran smoothly over the vast South Sea, pure blue now from rim to unimaginably distant rim. "I have known him hang about most shamefully when it was a question of a wench. Nelson, too, and many a post-captain, many an admiral when adultery was concerned. No fine-spun scruples about the king's ship then. No, no, no. Scruples are kept for natural philosophy alone, or any useful discovery. 'Tis so to the devil, false hypocritical dog. But he's probably unaware of his falsity. Pravimest cor omnium, the heart is perverse above all things and unsearchable. Who shall know it?" Yet although Stephen was of a saturnine and revengeful temperament, he had been brought up to a high notion of hospitality. The captain was the gunroom's guest, and the ship's surgeon was not to sit there in silent, dogged resentment. Putting a considerable force on himself, Stephen uttered 4 civil remarks, and after a proper interval he said, "A glass of wine with you, sir," bowing low. "I must congratulate you most heartily, Doctor, on your preservation of young Blakeney," said Jack, returning his bow. "How I could have told our old shipmate that we'd let his son perish of grape-shot, I don't know. A grape-shot in these circumstances, I mean, not a French or American one. How could he possibly have come to swallow such a thing?" asked Martin. "When I was a reefer and any of the youngsters talked too much, we used to make him hold one in his mouth," said Jack. "We called them gobstoppers. I dare say that's how it came about." "May I send you a piece of bonito, sir?" asked Howard from the middle of the table. "If you please. A capital fish bonito, capital. I could eat it forever. I caught 7 this morning, sir, sitting in the mizzen change and casting along the edge of the wake. I sent 1 to the sick bay, 1 to the midshipman's berth, 3 to my marines, and kept the best for us." "Capital, capital," said Jack again. And indeed it was a capital dinner altogether. Best green turtle, a delicate flying squid come aboard in the night, a variety of fishes, dolphin pie, and to crown all, a great dish of teal. Galapagos teal, indistinguishable in taste from Christian teal, that had been netted by Howard's sergeant, a former poacher. And Stephen noticed, not without irritation, that as he ate and drank, his civility was growing less artificial, his deliberately urbane expression more nearly a spontaneous smile, and that he was in danger of enjoying himself. "Behold the threadened sails, borne with the invisible and creeping wind, draw the huge bottoms through the furrowed sea, breasting the lofty surge," said Merritt, in a momentary silence as the decanters were renewed. He and Martin had been discussing poetry for some time. "That's the kind of thing I mean." "Did you write that, Merritt?" asked Jack.
"No, sir," said Merritt. It was another cove."
"The invisible and creeping wind," repeated Maitland. "They say pigs can see the wind."
"Stay, gentlemen," cried Howard, holding up his hand and looking round with a flushed face and a gleaming eye. "You must forgive me, but I don't often come up with a good thing at the right moment. Haven't done so since this commission, I believe, though I came pretty close to it once off the River Plate. So, by your leave, sir," bowing to Jack, "there was an old woman in the Cove of Cork that lived in a cabin with just one room, no more. She bought a pig." "A pig, eh? That's the point. That's what makes it so apposite. And they said, 'What shall you do about the smell?' Because it had to live in the same room, if you follow me. The pig had to live in the same room as the old woman. 'Oh, a home,' says she. 'Begar, he'll have to get used to it.' Mistaking, you see." But Howard's explanation was drowned in a gale of laughter led by Killick from behind Jack's chair. Jack himself said, "He'll have to get used to it," threw himself back and had his laugh out, his face scarlet and his eyes a brighter blue than usual. "Dear me! Dear me!" he said at last, wiping them with his handkerchief. "If this veil of tears, it does a man good to laugh from time to time." When they were quiet, the purser peered round his neighbours at the first lieutenant and asked, "Was that piece you said just now poetry, the piece before the pig?" "Yes, it was," said Merritt.
"It didn't rhyme," said Adams. "I told it over to myself and it didn't rhyme. If Rowan were here, he'd knock your poet on the head. His poetry always rhymes. I remember a piece of his as though it were only yesterday. 'Awful the grinding noise of keel and heel, with an unusual motion made the crew to reel.'
I believe there are almost as many kinds of poetry as there are rigs, observed the master.
So there are two, said Stephen. Do you remember that dear Ahmed Smythe, Mr. Stanhope's Oriental secretary, when we were going to Kampong? He told me of a curious Malay form of verse whose name escapes me, though I've retained an example. The peepal tree grows on the edge of the forest. On the fisherman's strand, nets lie in hopeless confusion. It is true that I am sitting on your knee, but you are not therefore to suppose that you may take any other liberty at all.
Did it rhyme in Malay?
Asked the purser after a silent pause.
It did, said Stephen. The first and the third, the arrival of the pudding, cut him short. A most uncommonly splendid pudding brought in with conscious pride and welcomed with applause.
What is this? Cried Jack.
We thought you'd be surprised, sir, said Mowat. It's a floating island.
Or rather a floating archipelago.
It's the Galapagos themselves, said Jack. Here's Albemarle. Here's Narborough. Here's Chatham and Hood. I had no idea there was anyone aboard capable of such a thing. A masterpiece, upon my word and honour, fit for a flagship. One of the whalers made it, sir. He was a pastry cook in Danzig before he took to sea.
I put in the lines of longitude and latitude, said the master. They're made of spun sugar. So's the equator, but double thick and dyed with port.
The Galapagos,
said Jack, gazing down on them.
The whole shooting match.
There's even the Redondo Rock and Cowley's Enchanted Isle laid down exactly, and to think we never set foot on a single one. Sometimes ours is a very demanding profession.
Stern daughter of the voice of God, O duty, said Mowat.
But Jack, musing over the archipelago, which swayed with the heave of the ship, didn't hear him and went on.
But I tell you what, gentlemen, if we come back this way, having done what we set out to do, we shall lie in Mr. Allen's cove on James Island for a few days, and everyone shall have leave to roam to his heart's content.
Will you not take some Galapagos, sir, before it comes adrift? Said Mowat.
I hesitate to spoil such a work of art, said Jack, but unless we're to go without our pudding...
This with a pretty knowing look as he poised his spoon above the pastry cook's equator.
I believe I must cut the line.
The line. The line.
Day after day they sailed westwards along the line,
or a little south of it.
They left the penguins and the seals behind almost at once, all the inshore birds and almost all the fish. They also left the gloom, the cool water, and the low-hanging cloud. And they sailed over a dark blue disk, perpetually renewed under a pale blue dome occasionally flecked with very high white cirrus. But they didn't sail at all fast. In spite of the Surprise's splendid display of light, fair-weather canvas, stunsails aloft and alow, royals and even skysails and skyscrapers, she rarely logged more than 100 miles between one observation and the next. Almost every day the breeze dozed for 2 or 3 hours after midday, or even went fast asleep, leaving the pyramids of sail in a dismal state of sag, while vast stretches of dead calm spread over the sea, broken only by the passage of whales, sperm whales, that would sometimes pass in wide-spaced files, 200 and even 300 strong, heading for Peru. And every evening at the setting of the watch, the Surprise snugged down to topsails. There was no trusting the sudden flurries of the night in spite of the lamb-like innocence of the day. These were waters largely unknown to the Navy. Byron, Wallace and Cook had kept much farther south or much farther north. And this slow creeping over an apparently infinite sea would have fretted Jack to the very heart if he hadn't learnt, through the master, that here it was always the case when the sun began to move backwards from the tropic, and it would be as bad for the Norfolk, or possibly worse. Alan had had many a conversation with the specksioneer, a middle-aged man named Hogg, who had made the run to the Marquesas 3 times and the Sandwich Islands 2 times. And his experience, both first and second hand, was a great relief to all hands aboard. They sailed on as fast as they reasonably could, but not as though they had a chase in view, not wetting the sails throughout the urgent day, since they knew that the Norfolk would proceed at an even more moderate pace. And when she reached the Marquesas, she would spend a great while cruising among the islands in search of the British whalers fishing there. There was not a moment to spare, it was true, but then not every moment had to be flogged. Once again, and with surprising speed, the ship settled down to a perfectly regular, self-sufficing existence. Very soon it became the natural way of life once more, and the surprises looked back to the remote and bitterly cold days far south of the Horn, and even to their haunted passage up the coast of Chile and Peru, as to another world. The sun rose every morning exactly in the frigate's wake. It shone on the new clean decks, but soon they were hidden from view by awnings, for although this was not Gulf of Guinea hot, with the pitch bubbling from the seams and tar dripping from on high, still less the Red Sea of infamous memory, the temperature was in the 80s and shade was grateful. Everybody walked about in dark, except for invitations to the cabin, and even for them the midshipmen were excused their thick kerseymere waistcoats. Yet they were perhaps the only people who were not quite pleased about the return to proper blue-water sailoring with everything just so ship-shape and Bristol fashion. Greek and Latin had never indeed been laid entirely aside, except for the very worst days in the 50s and 60s, but now both came back with redoubled force, and now Captain Aubrey had time to lead them through the mazes of navigation, while at night he made them learn the name, declination and right ascension of a great many stars, and find out the angular distance between these and various planets or the moon. He and Mowat also had time to set about improving their morals, which in the naval context meant leaving their comfortable hammocks very early indeed, relieving the watch well before the stroke of the bell, never putting their hands in the pockets, or leaning on the rail, or resting on a carronade slide, and always attending in the tops whenever sails were reefed. "You're called reefers," Merritt told them one day. "You're given a sumptuous berth, you're fed like fighting cocks, and all that's asked of you is to attend in the tops when the sails are being reefed. But what do I find? The main t'gallantsail being supervised from the head?" "Oh, sir," cried Nesbit, stung with the injustice, "I was caught short just that once. And the foretopsail apparently reefing itself, while the midshipman was rioting in swinish slumber somewhere below. I really grieve for the service if it's to be officered by such creatures as you, who think of nothing but eating and sleeping and neglecting their duty. I've never seen the like in any ship before, and never wish to see it again." "These youngsters think too much of their ease," said Jack. "They're nothing but a parcel of helots." "Pray, have helots a particular nautical signification, like dogs, mice, fishes, and so on?" asked Stephen. "Oh, no, just the ordinary sense of idle young devils, you know, limbs of Satan. I must stir them up and make their lives a misery." Whatever his attempts may have been, they were not successful. The surprise had a sprightly, high-spirited midshipman's berth, with no real oldsters to tyrannise over the rest. And so far, at least, its members had plenty to eat. They'd long since recovered from the hardships of the far south, although nothing would bring Williamson's toes back, nor the tips of his ears. Boyle's ribs had knit perfectly, while a faint down was beginning to cover not only Callum's bald scalp, but also his girlish chin. In spite of hard duty and hard lessons, and in spite of moral improvement, they remained cheerful. What is more, they learnt how to swim. In the afternoon, when the ship was becalmed, most of the people plunged over the side, most into a shallow swimming bath made of a sunken sail, but some into the open sea itself, for no sharks had been seen since they left the Galapagos, at least none that followed the ship. This was one of the delights of their westward course. Another was the competitive firing of the great guns or small arms almost every evening at quarters. But there were many more, and the most highly prized, deeply relished during the first weeks, was the conduct of the whalers, particularly of their chief, the Spectroneer Hogg. He'd never been in the Royal Navy. Although the war had been going on with little interruption since his boyhood, he'd never been pressed. As a South Sea whaler and a harpooner, he had a protection, but he had never had to use it. Neither the press gang nor the impress officer had ever troubled him, and, in fact, he'd never set foot on board a man of war before the surprise. His life had been spent entirely in whalers, a particularly democratic set of vessels in which the hands worked not for wages, but for shares of what the ship might earn, and in which, although there was the necessary minimum of discipline, there was little sense of hierarchy among the 30-odd people. Certainly nothing resembling that of the Navy, with its far greater numbers, its different worlds afore the mast and abaft it, its different essences of humanity. He was an intelligent man. He could navigate. But he had a certain simplicity. And having spent his childhood in the heathen slums of Wapping and the rest of his life among whalers, he'd had little contact with civilization. Meeting the officer of the watch on his first morning, for example, he called out, "How are you coming along, mate? Prime, I hope, prime." And when church was rigged, it was difficult to make him set down in his right place. "Well, this is a rum go," he said in a loud voice when at last he was settled on an upturned mess kid. And he stared very much during the hymns, clapping when they were done. When Mr. Martin put on his surplice, his neighbour told him in what passed for a whisper among seamen that Parson was now going to preach them a sermon. "Is he, though?" cried Hogg, leaning forward with both hands on his knees and watching the chaplain with keen interest. "I never heard a sermon." Then, after a few minutes, "You've turned over two pages. Ain't it? You turned over two pages, master." It was true, for Martin, an indifferent preacher, generally read from some more gifted man, such as South or Barrow. And now, flustered by his new parishioners, he had indeed made a sad and obvious blunder. "Silence, fore and aft," cried Merritt. "But he's turned over two pages," said Hogg. "Bonden," said Jack in a church-going aside, "lead Hogg forward and tell him how we do it in the Navy." Bonden told him, but he can't have made the principle quite plain, for the next day, when Nesbitt, the smallest of the reefers, was bawling orders to some hands in the foretop, he used a coarse expression. And Hogg suddenly turned, held him up with one hand and slapped his buttocks with the other, telling him he should be ashamed of speaking so to men old enough to be his daddy. Any court-martial sitting on Hogg's crime would have been compelled to sentence him to death, for the 22nd Article of War provided no less penalty. Jack caused Mowat and Alan to speak to him at some length, and they brought him to some sense of the enormity of his act. But even so, the rest of the ship's company didn't despair of seeing the whalers tell Mr. Adams just what they thought of his purser's dips, for example, or trouble the captain for a glass of his best brandy when they felt inclined for a wet. And they often urged him to do so. "Go on, mate," they said. "Don't be bashful. The skipper loves a foremast jack, and he'll always give a glass if he asks civil." It wasn't that they disliked their new shipmates. Far from it, indeed, for the whalers were not only amiable, but thorough-paced seamen as well. But their innocence was a standing temptation, and, in principle, when the surprises were tempted, they fell. Before Church was rigged again, the whalers had grown wary. Although they could still be made to leap half asleep from their hammocks by the cry of "There she blows," they would no longer go to the carpenter's mate and ask for a long stand, nor to the gunner's yeoman for half a fathom of firing line. Yet even so, they did give a great deal of innocent pleasure when an American whaler appeared at an immense distance to windward, standing east, a vessel instantly recognisable from a double-deck crow's nest on the main. Hogg and his friends rushed aft in a body filled with passion and a wild longing for revenge. And when Honey, who had the watch, wouldn't instantly haul to the wind, they began bawling down to Jack through the skylight and had to be removed by the marines. A moment's consideration showed Jack that chasing the American would mean far too great a loss of time. He sent for the specksioneer and said, "Hogg, we've been very patient with you and your shipmates, but if you carry on like this, I shall be obliged to punish you." "They burnt our ship," muttered Hogg. Jack feigned not to hear, but seeing the man's hot tears of rage and disappointment, he said, "Never mind it, man. The Norfolk's perhaps not so very far away, and you shall serve them out." Even if she were already in the Marquesas, she would not be so very far away by now, as these things were reckoned in the prodigious expanse of the Pacific, where something in the nature of 1,000 miles seemed the natural unit. Another unit might be a poem. Stephen was reading Mowat's Iliad, and he was keeping to one book a day, no more, to make his pleasure last. He'd begun a little while after leaving the Galapagos, and he was now in Book 12, and he reckoned that at the present rate of sailing he would finish just before they reached the Marquesas. He did his reading in the afternoons, for now that the days were calm and untroubled, with the necessary weeks of their western passage taken out of time, as it were, a self-contained whole, he and Jack filled the evenings with the music they'd been obliged to forego in more demanding waters. Night after night they played there in the great cabin with the stern windows open and the ship's wake flowing away and away in the darkness. Few things gave them more joy. And although they were as unlike in nationality, education, religion, appearance, and habit of mind as two men could well be, they were wholly at one when it came to improvising, working out variations on a theme, handing them to and fro, conversing with violin and cello. Though this was a language in which Jack was somewhat more articulate than his friend, wittier, more original, and indeed more learned. They were alike in their musical tastes, in their reasonably high degree of amateur skill, and in their untiring relish. But on the evening of the day in which Stephen had reconciled Achilles and Agamemnon, and when the frigate's wake was rather better than 2,000 miles long, they didn't play at all. This was partly because the ship was passing through an immense population of phosphorescent marine organisms, and had been passing through it ever since the dark red sun set into the misty sea, his disk neatly divided by the bowsprit, but even more because the hands had been turned up to sing and dance on the forecastle, and they were making much more noise than usual. The order was purely formal, since the hands were already there, dancing and singing as they always did on fine evenings when the ship was sailing easy, and its only function was to let them know that they might keep it up, this being the whaler's particular feast day. "I'm glad I cancelled the youngster's lesson," said Jack, looking up through the open skylight. "There's scarcely a star to be seen. Jupiter's no more than a blur, and I don't suppose that even he'll last another 5 minutes."
"Perhaps it was on Wednesday," replied Stephen at the stern window, leaning far out and down.
"I said Jupiter will not last another 5 minutes," said Jack in a voice calculated to drown the merriment afore. But it was badly calculated, not having taken the whalers into account. And they had just begun, "Away, my boys, away, my boys, 'tis time for us to go," in voices that would have suited the whales themselves. Stephen answered, "Probably Wednesday," I said, in a rather impatient tone. "Will you not pass me the long-handled net now? I've asked you 3 times, and there's a creature I just cannot reach with this miserable..." Jack found the long-handled net quite soon, but when he came to pass it, there was no Stephen in the stern window, only a strangled voice from the wake, "A rope! A rope!" "Clap onto the cutter!" cried Jack, and he dived straight in. He didn't hail the ship on coming to the surface, because he knew the red cutter was towing astern. Stephen would either seize it or be towed towards it, and then they could regain the stern window without the ship's way being checked, or her surgeon being still further exposed for what, in fact, he was, the most hopeless lubber yet born. No cutter. Someone must have hauled the boat alongside. No Stephen either. But at that moment he saw and heard a gasping boil that rose and sank in the troubled phosphorescent water. He dived again, swimming deeper and deeper, until he saw his friend against the luminous surface. Stephen had become strangely entangled in his own net, his head and one elbow tight in its meshes, its handle down the back of his shirt. Jack got him out, but breaking the stout handle, ripping off the shirt, and at the same time holding Stephen so that his head was above water, took some while, and when at last he drew breath and shouted, "Surprise, ahoy!" the hail coincided with the roaring chorus, "There she blows, there she blows, there she blows," taken up by the whole ship's company. He'd set Stephen to float on his back, which he could do tolerably well when the sea was calm, but an unfortunate ripple washing over his face just as he breathed in sank him again. Again he had to be brought up, and now Jack, "Surprise, ahoy!" coming at the full pitch of his powerful voice, had an edge of anxiety to it, for although the ship wasn't sailing fast, every minute she moved more than 100 yards, and already her lights were dimming in the mist. Hail after hail after hail. Enough to startle the dead. But when she was no more than the blur of the planet earlier in the night, he fell silent. And Stephen said, "I'm extremely concerned, Jack, that my awkwardness should have brought you into such very grave danger." "Oh, bless you," said Jack, "it ain't so very grave as all that. Killick's bound to come into the cabin in about 30 minutes or so, and it'll put the ship about directly." "But do you think they will ever see us, with this fog and no moon, no moon at all?" "They may find it a little difficult, although it's amazing how something that floats shows up on the night sea when you're looking for it. In any case, I shall hail every so often, like a minute gun, to help them. But, you know, it had been no very great harm were we to have to wait until day. The water's as warm as milk. There's no kind of a sea apart from the swell. And if you stretch out your arms, stick out your belly and throw your head back till your ears are awash, you'll find you float as easy as kiss my hand. The minute gun hails succeeded one another in a long, long series. Stephen floated easy, and they drifted westwards on the equatorial current, westwards and probably a little north. Jack reflected upon the relativity of motion, upon the difficulty of measuring the speed or set of a current if your ship is moving with it and you can neither anchor nor observe any fixed point of land, and he wondered how Mowat would set about searching once the alarm was raised. If the observations were conscientiously made and the log accurately heaved, read and recorded, then it wouldn't be very hard for him to run back close-hauled, or even with the wind 1 point free, always provided that the breeze remained steady at southeast by south and that his estimate of the current was correct. Each degree of error in that would, in the course of an hour's sailing at 4.5 knots, amount to... In the midst of his calculations, he became aware that Stephen, lying there as stiff as a board, was becoming distressed. "Stephen," he said, pushing him, for Stephen's head was thrown back so far that he couldn't easily hear. "Stephen! Turn over. Put your arms round my neck and we'll swim for a little." Then, as he felt Stephen's feet on the back of his legs, "You've not kicked off your shoes. Don't you know you must kick off your shoes? What a fellow you are, Stephen." So they went on, sometimes swimming gently, sometimes floating in the lukewarm sea, rising and falling on the very long, regular swell. They didn't talk much, though Stephen did observe that it was all very much easier now that he was allowed to change position from time to time. Even the act of floating came to him more naturally with use. "I believe I may set up as a Triton." And on another occasion he said, "I'm very deeply indebted to you, Jack, for supporting me in this way." Once Jack found that he must have slept a while, and once they were rocked by a sudden upsurge of water quite close at hand, a looming on the swell, and they were in the enormous presence of a whale. As far as they could make out in the phosphorescence, he was an old bull, rather better than 80 feet long. He lay there for perhaps 10 minutes, spouting at steady intervals. They could see the white jet and faintly hear it. And then, with a great inward sigh, he put down his head, raised his flukes clear of the sea, and silently vanished. Shortly after this, the mist began to clear. The stars showed through, at first dimly and then brilliantly clear. And to his relief, Jack saw that the dawn was closer than he'd supposed. It was not that he had much hope of being rescued now. That had depended on Killick's looking into the cabin before going to bed. There was no particular reason why he should have looked in, and clearly he hadn't done so. Otherwise, Mowat would have turned well before the end of the first watch. He would have cracked on with all the sail she could bear, and with all the boats strung out within hailing distance on either side, he would have combed a broad stretch of sea, picking them up sometime early in the middle watch. And the middle watch was already over. But if Mowat didn't hear of their absence till the morning, clearly the dear Surprise would have sailed that much farther west, and she couldn't be brought back much before the evening. The probability of error from the current would be very, very much greater, and in any case he didn't think they could hold out much beyond dawn. Almost certainly not until the late afternoon. Although the sea had seemed so warm to begin with, they were both of them shivering convulsively by now. They were waterlogged. Jack, for one, was overcome by an enormous hunger, and both of them were haunted by the fear of sharks. Neither had spoken for a long time, apart from the brief words when they changed position and when Jack towed Stephen on his shoulders for a while. There was very little hope now, he admitted. Yet he did long for the light. The heat of the sun might revive them wonderfully. And it was not wholly inconceivable that a coral island might appear, although the charts showed none for another 300 or 400 miles. These were largely uncharted waters. Hogg had spoken of islands known to whalers and sandalwood cutters alone. Their observed positions kept private. But what he really hoped for was a piece of driftwood. Palm trunks were almost indestructible, and in the course of the last few days he'd seen several drifting on the current, born perhaps from the Guatemalan shore. And with one of those to buoy them up, they could last all day and more. Much more. He turned it over in his mind. The ways of dealing with a palm trunk and how to give it some kind of stability with an outrigger in the South Seas fashion. Almost wholly useless reflection, but even so better than the piercing, sterile, pointless regrets that had tormented him for the last few hours. Regrets about leaving Sophie surrounded with lawsuits. Regrets for not having managed things more cleverly. Bitter regret at having to leave life behind and all those he loved. The earth turned, and the ocean with it. The water in which they swam turned towards the sun. Over in the west there was the last of the night, and in the east to windward the first of the day. And there, clear against the lightning sky, lay a vessel. Already quite near, a very large, two-masted, double-hulled canoe with a broad platform or deck overlapping the hulls with a thatched house upon it, and the vessel had two towering fore and aft sails, each with a curved crest reaching forwards. These, however, were details that Jack did not consciously observe until he'd uttered a great roaring hail. It roused Stephen, who had been in something not far from a coma. "A South Sea craft!" cried Jack, pointing, and he hailed again. The vessel was very like what Captain Cook called a pahi. "Would they take us up, do you suppose?" asked Stephen. "Oh, surely," said Jack. And he saw a narrow outrigger canoe put off from the vessel's side, hoist a triangular sail, and come racing down towards them. One young woman sat in the stern steering. Another straddled the booms connecting the slender hull and the outrigger, balancing with wonderful grace. She held a spear in her hand, and as the other girl let fly the sheet, bringing the canoe almost to a halt 3 yards from them, she was all poised to throw. But seeing what they were, she paused, frowning, quite amazed. The other one laughed. A fine flash of white teeth. They were both strikingly good-looking young women, brown, long-legged, dressed in little kilts and no more. Ordinarily, Jack was attentive to an elegant form, an elegant bosom, a well-rounded shape. But now he wouldn't have cared if they'd been old man baboons, so long as they took him and Stephen aboard. He lifted up his hands and uttered a supplicatory croak. Stephen did the same. But the girls, laughing, filled and ran back the way they'd come, sailing with extraordinary skill and speed, unbelievably close to the wind. Yet as they swept off, they smiled and they made motions signifying, perhaps, that the outrigger was too frail for any more weight, and that Jack and Stephen might swim to the two-master. That was how Jack's willing mind interpreted them. And in fact, when they reached the double canoe, which in any case was bearing down upon them, these same girls and several others helped them up onto the mat-covered deck. There appeared to be a positive crowd of young women and a good many older and stouter. But this wasn't time for fine observation. Jack said, thank you, ma'am, very earnestly to the cheerful helmswoman who had given him a particularly hearty hand, and looked all his gratitude at the rest, while Stephen said, ladies, I am obliged beyond measure. Then they sat down with hanging heads, scarcely aware of their pleasure, and dripped upon the deck, shivering uncontrollably. There was a great deal of talk above them. They were certainly addressed at length by two or three of the older women and questioned, and sometimes brown hands plucked at their hair and clothes. But little notice did they take until Jack felt the power of the sun warming him through and through as it mounted. His trembling stopped. Hunger and thirst came upon him with redoubled force, and turning to the women who were still watching with close attention, he made gestures begging for food and drink. There was some discussion, and two of the middle-aged women seemed to disapprove, but some of the younger ones stepped down into the starboard hull and brought up green coconuts, a small bundle of dried fishes, and two baskets, one containing sour breadfruit pap and the other dried bananas. How quickly humanity and pleasure in being alive flowed back with food and drink and the warmth of the sun! They looked about them and smiled and renewed their thanks. The stern, broad-shouldered spear-girl and her jollier companion seemed to think them to some degree their property. The one opened the drinking coconuts and passed them, the other handed the dried fishes one by one. But not very valuable property. The spear-girl, whose name appeared to be Teo, looked at the white, hairy, waterlogged, water-wrinkled skin of Jack's leg where his trousers were rolled back, and uttered a sound of sincere and candid disgust, while the other, Manu, took hold of a lock of his long yellow hair, now untied and hanging down his back, plucked out a few strands, turned them in her fingers and tossed them over the side, shaking her head and then carefully washing her hands. By now the scene changed, almost as it might have done in a man of war, though there was no evident signal, no pipe, no bell. Part of the crew began washing most scrupulously, first hanging over the water, then diving in and swimming like dolphins. They paid no attention whatsoever to nakedness. Others took up the mats covering the platform, shook them to leeward, lashed them down again in a seaman-like manner, and heaved on the forestays, now slackening with the heat of the sun, while a third party brought up small pigs, edible dogs and fowls in baskets, mostly from the larboard hull, and arranged them on the forward part of the deck, where they sat good and quiet, as shipboard animals so often do. During all this activity, no one had much time to stare at them, and Stephen, whose spirits had recovered wonderfully, grew less discreet in looking about. He considered first the hurrying crew, which seemed to consist of about a score of young women and nine or ten between old and young, together with an indefinite number heard but not seen in the deckhouse aft. A dozen of the young women were cheerful, unaffected creatures, good-looking, though often heavily tattooed, full of curiosity, talk and laughter, and reasonably friendly, though it was clear that they considered Jack and Stephen physically unattractive, if not worse. The young women, and most of those of 30 or 40, were more reserved, if not downright inimical. Stephen suspected that they didn't approve of the rescue, still less of the feeding of those saved from the sea. But, whatever their opinion, all the women talked all the time in a mellifluous language that he took to be that of Polynesia in general. All the women, that is to say, except four of the youngest, who sat industriously chewing the root from which kava was made and spitting the fibrous pulp into a bowl. Stephen knew that once coconut milk had been stirred in and the mixture had stood for a while, it would be ready to drink. He'd read a few accounts of the islands, but since he had had no idea of visiting them this commission, he'd learnt nothing of their language, and he retained no more than a word or two from his books, of which kava was one. He therefore sat uncomprehending in the babble, and presently his mind wandered from this curious community, a sea-going convent, to their vessel. It was obviously stocked for a long voyage, one of those very long Polynesian voyages of which he'd heard, and it certainly seemed capable of undertaking one. He much admired the two smooth hulls upon which the platform and its house reposed, the windward hull acting as a counterpoise in a side breeze, so that there was a much greater lateral stability as well as much less friction, an improvement that might well be introduced into the Navy. The idea of the Navy's considering a man-of-war with two hulls for a moment, after the terrible outcry it had raised about a slight change in the traditional stern, made him smile. And his eye ran along the tall, rising stems in which these particular hulls ended, their prows, as it were, or figureheads. And here some indistinct recollections of that black, though ingenious, Cromwellian thief, Sir William Petty, and his double-bottomed vessel were driven clear out of his mind. For lashed to the starboard stem was a carving some 6 feet high, a very lively carving of three men. The first had the second standing on his shoulders, and the second the third. And these three were connected by the huge penis which rose from the loins of the first, towering past the second to a point above the third man's head, and held by all three as it mounted. It was coloured red and purple, and it had no doubt reached higher still, but it had been much gashed and mutilated, and now there was no telling whether it was common to them all, though this seemed probable. All the figures had been castrated, and judging by the freshness and the rough texture of the splintered wood, this had been done quite recently and with a coarse instrument. "Dear me," he murmured, and turned his attention to the other stem. This bore a tall piece of wood, adz flattened on its two faces with the side indented or crenellated in regular squares. It had something of the air and presence of a totem pole, and it was topped by a skull. The skull didn't surprise Stephen very much. He'd already noticed one rolling about among the coconut balers, and he knew they had no great significance in the South Seas. But it was with real concern that he saw, and after a moment recognised, the little wizened, purse-like objects pinned to the slab. as vermin might be to a European gamekeeper's door. He was about to tell Jack of his discovery and his conclusions, to caution him against the least ill humour, and to advise submission, a deferential bearing, and above all, no hint of gallantry, however innocent, when he found that he was alone. Jack had left him when the second part of the crew started their washing and the first set about arranging their hair, all this on the windward side of the platform. He walked aft along to the other side, taking great notice of the shaped planks, sewn together edge to edge and caulked with what he took to be coconut fibre mixed with something sticky. Of the cordage and the sails, made a fine matting with an immensely long piece of creeper or supplejack as a bolt rope, and skirting the deck-house, in which several women were all talking at once in loud, contentious voices, he came to the helm. It was a large paddle, but to his astonishment he found that it was not moved from side to side rudder fashion, but thrust down to turn from the wind and raised to luff it up. The woman who held it had a sensible, manly look, as far as could be seen through the complex lines and spirals of her tattoo. She understood him quite readily, demonstrated the use of the paddle, and showed him that the vessel could come tolerably close to the wind, though, of course, you had to reckon on a good deal of leeway. She showed the angle with her parted fingers and blew to indicate the increasing force of the wind. But she could make nothing of his other inquiries to do with the stars, navigation by night, and the vessel's destination, even though he illustrated them with gestures. He was trying to make himself plainer when three stout, middle-aged women like bosun's mates came round the corner from the deck-house, gasped with indignation, and hustled him forward at a great pace, one helping him on his way with a flying kick that would have done credit to a spithead nightingale. All three, and some of the other women, seemed very angry. They railed and scolded for a quarter of an hour, and then Jack was given a mortar with some dried roots in it and a heavy pestle, while Stephen was put to mind a young hog. Like most of the animals on deck, it was in a basket, but unlike the others, it was restless and in poor health. It had to be nursed, and it wouldn't keep still. For some time the bosun's mates stood just behind, pinching and slapping them if the hog complained, or the roots skipped out of the mortar, and sometimes for no reason at all. But presently other duties called them away, and in a low voice Jack said, "I should never have gone aft. We're clearly foremast hands no more, and was never moved from here unless we're told." Stephen was about to agree, and to add his recommendations about their behaviour, his hypothesis on the nature of this community and the purpose of its voyage, and some remarks on the prevalence of cannibalism in the South Seas, when Jack interrupted, saying, "Ain't you hellfire thirsty, Stephen? I am. I believe it was those dried fish. But, you know, they don't seem to like the look of me, whereas you're almost as brown as they are." "This I attribute to my practice of application," said Stephen, looking at his bare belly with some complacency. It was true. Stephen regularly sat in the tops with nothing on, and he had none of the dank, corpse-like pallor of naked Europeans. "I have little doubt that to them you resemble a leper, or at any rate something diseased, unwholesome. The colour of your hair is disgusting. To those who are not used to it, I mean." "Yes," said Jack. "So pray be a good fellow and sing out to the girl forward there among the coconuts." Stephen's first gentle call, accompanied by a timid gesture of drinking, was unsuccessful. She pursed her lips and looked coldly away with a righteous expression. His second had more luck. Manu was passing by, and she brought four nuts across and opened the shells with a shark's tooth set in a handle. And as they drank the exquisite milk, she spoke to them rather severely, no doubt telling them something for their own good. At one time she put her hands together as though in prayer and looked emphatically aft. They could make nothing of it at all. But they both nodded gravely and said, "Yes, indeed, ma'am, certainly, we're most obliged to you." Once again Stephen was about to tell Jack of his intimate conviction derived not only from the figureheads but from many little signs, forms of behaviour, caresses, quarrels and reconciliations, that they were aboard a vessel belonging to women who didn't like men, who had revolted from the tyranny of men, and who were sailing away to some island, perhaps a great way off, to set up a female commonwealth, and to say that he dreaded the possibility of Jack's being gelded, knocked on the head and eaten. But before he could do so, his hog grew restless, squealed and fouled the deck. At the same time, Jack was seen to be idling with his pestle, and the boatswain's mates stepped in. When the mess was cleaned, and Stephen's trousers too, this they insisted upon, having an exceedingly high standard of cleanliness, they made him take them off and wring them out again and again before they were satisfied. And when all the shouting, cuffing, pinching, slapping, and reproof had died down, Jack said, "Here comes the captain, I believe, and the officers." She was a broad, squat woman, much darker than most, with a long trunk and short legs. She had a handsome high nose but exceedingly cross and authoritarian face. And as she made her tour of the vessel, she was accompanied by two taller women, obviously stupid and obviously devoted to her. They both carried the same weapons, a 3-foot palm rib topped with a hardwood knob with mother-of-pearl eyes on either side of an obsidian beak, possibly a mark of rank, since they held them with a certain amount of pomp. She had no mark of rank, far from it. She was casually nibbling at something she held. But as she came forward, the members of the crew stood with their hands clasped and their heads bowed. "Perhaps we should adopt a respectful, submissive attitude," murmured Stephen. And as the captain came nearer, he saw that what she was gnawing was a hand, a smoked or pickled hand. She looked at Jack and Stephen without any pleasure or interest, and without making any reply to their bows or their "Your most humble, devoted servant, ma'am, and most honoured and happy to be aboard you, ma'am." And having looked at them, she entered into a long, displeased conversation with Teo and Manu, who, in spite of their clasped hands, spoke up very freely in their clear young voices. Stephen suspected that they belonged to a privileged class. They were taller, lighter in colour, and their tattooing was quite different. And the captain's attitude towards Manu in particular was civiller than it was to the others. The captain and her officers went by, walking aft along the larboard side. And a little later Jack, having turned the mortar so that he could see, said, "I believe they're rigging church." Indeed, something very like an altar appeared in the middle of the platform, and 6 mother-of-pearl discs and an obsidian knife were laid upon it, with a variety of weapons ranged in front. Again Jack and Stephen slackened a little in their attention to work, and again some sort of ship's corporal brought them back to a sense of duty with a furious roar. She then harangued them at length with gestures, and although no single word had any meaning, it was clear from her intonation that sometimes she was describing the conduct of the virtuous, sometimes that of the worthless. And behind her, Teo, Manu, and 6 of the jollier girls imitated her gestures and her expressions with such perfection that at last Jack couldn't contain but burst out into a strangled horse laugh. The ship's corporal started to the row of weapons and came at him with just such a beaked club as the officers carried, a tool designed to peck through a skull at a single blow. But, in fact, she only kicked him in the stomach. She'd barely done so before the whole thing was over. Everybody was shrieking and pointing over the side, where Manu had sighted a shark close on the starboard beam. It was a medium-sized brute, 12 or 13 feet long, though of what species Stephen couldn't tell. Nor had he any time for deliberation, for Manu, catching up the obsidian knife from the altar, slipped into the sea between the two hulls. What happened next he couldn't make out, but there was a furious threshing convulsion a few yards out to starboard, and there were the girls and the ship's corporal laughing heartily as Manu came dripping aboard and the shark dropped astern, disemboweled but still lashing with enormous force. Clearly no one but Jack and Stephen thought it out of the way. The others carried on with their preparations for church as though nothing of importance had happened, except that two of them helped Manu rearrange her wet hair. A boatswain's mate, now dressed in a striped garment with tags, had just time to throw Jack more roots to grind and to give him a passing swipe with the rope's end, and drums started to beat. The ceremony began with a dance. Two lines of women facing the captain, rhythmically advancing, retiring, waving their weapons while she chanted, and at the end of each verse they all cried, "Wah-hoo!" Their weapons were spears. The hardwood skull splitter called Patu Patu, a name that came to Stephen the moment he saw it, and clubs, some studded with human teeth, some with those of sharks. And all the women, even the carver-chewing girls, handled them most convincingly. The dance went on and on and on, the drumbeat acquiring a hypnotic quality.
"Stephen," whispered Jack, "I must go to the head."
"Very well," said Stephen, calming his hog. "I've seen the women do so repeatedly. They mostly go over the side."
"But I shall have to take off my trousers," said Jack.
"Then no doubt it would be more seemly to dip between the two floaters holding on to the platform. For although they seem to be as innocent as Eve before the apple, at least as far as nakedness is concerned, they may not view the shameful parts of a man in quite the same light."
"I believe it was that dried fish," said Jack. "But perhaps I can wait. To tell you the truth, that ill-looking bitch," lowering his voice and nodding towards the captain, "quite daunts me. I don't know what she'd be at." "Go on, Jack, go on while you may. It may be worse later. Go on directly. I believe they're reaching their climax."
Rarely had Stephen given better advice. Jack hadn't been back to his pestle 5 minutes with a look of profound relief on his face before the dancing stopped and the ill-looking bitch delivered a long address, during which she often pointed at the men, growing steadily more passionate. The address came to an end, and the congregation got up and moved about. But this was only the beginning of the real ceremony. The fire that Jack had noticed on his way aft was brought forward, embers in a bowl that floated in another, and set down before the altar. Presently the smell of grilling flesh came forward together with ritual cries. But glancing discreetly round, Stephen observed that the captain and her officers were in fact drinking the kava prepared that morning. The flesh was only formal at this stage.
"Some say that kava's not truly intoxicating," remarked Stephen, "that it contains no alcohol. I wish they may be right."
Alcohol or no, the captain Her officers and the big, middle-aged women were obviously affected when at last they came forward, dancing heavily behind their leader, who held the obsidian knife in her hand. The effect would have been grotesque, but for the fact that the jawbones they had now hung round their necks were in most cases quite fresh, and that, drunk or not, they handled their weapons with great dexterity. The captain's mood had been disagreeable in the first place. It was now very much worse, much more fierce and aggressive. She stood in front of the men with her knees bent, her head thrust forward, pouring out words that sounded full of blame, indeed of intense hatred. Yet she didn't carry the whole crew with her. The older women were clearly on her side, and they often repeated her last words when she paused for breath, but several of the younger were not. They seemed uneasy, unwilling, displeased. And Manu and the spear girl obviously spoke for them when they broke in during the pauses or even frankly interrupted the full flow, so that on occasion at least three were talking at the same time. Manu was the chief interrupter, and Stephen became even more convinced that there was a special relation between her and the captain that gave her more than usual confidence. She kept pointing away over the starboard bow towards a little patch of white, unmoving cloud. But every time the captain brushed her words aside with the same set of phrases, then a sweep of the obsidian knife. Yet in spite of the captain's vehemence that increased with the last few interruptions, Stephen felt that she knew she was no longer in full control, that she'd gone on too long, that the climax was slipping away from her, and he was afraid that she'd do something exceptionally violent to re-establish the situation. Indeed, she did call out some orders, and the biggest of the women moved closer, some with cords, some with clubs. But once again, Manu interrupted. And before the captain could reply, Stephen stepped forward, and pointing at Jack's loins, he said, "Bah, bah, bah, taboo!" His third Polynesian word. It had an instant effect. "Taboo?" they said. "Taboo?" In every tone of affirmation, astonishment and concern, every tone but that of scepticism. The tension fell at once. The club bearers moved away, and Stephen sat down again with his hog, which had begun to whimper. He paid little attention to the subsequent discussion, which went on in a more normal tone, though he did notice accusations, tears, and reproaches. For a great while, Jack and Stephen had thought it more prudent, more discreet, not to speak. But now Jack whispered, "They've altered course." And Stephen observed that the vessel was heading for the patch of white cloud. Presently the talking died away. The captain and the officers retired to the deckhouse. Stephen's hog was taken from him and Jack's mortar. They were put to sit in the starboard hull among the drinking coconuts, and there, towards the middle of the afternoon, they were fed with little separate baskets of raw fish, breadfruit, pap, and taro. But there was no cheerfulness, no merriment, no curiosity. A flatness and gloom had come over the Pahi's company so lively before, and in spite of their enormous relief, it affected even Jack and Stephen as they sat there watching the clouds and then the little island under them come closer. When Manu brought the outrigger round to take them ashore, she'd clearly been crying. It was a charming little island. Not 10 acres in an infinity of sea. Green in the middle with a grove of palm trees. A brilliant white strand all round. And surrounding the whole, a broad coral reef 200 yards out. Manu obviously knew the island. She put the canoe through a gap in the reef so narrow that the outrigger clipped weed from the far side. She rounded to a few yards from the shore, and as Jack stood there up to his middle turning the canoe, she gave him 2 mother-of-pearl fish hooks and a length of fine line. Then she hauled in the sheet, Jack shoved her off, and the canoe raced back for the gap with the strong breeze abeam, and Manu standing up braced against it, as lovely a sight as could be imagined. They waved until she was far out at sea, but she never replied.